Okay, and our third speaker now is Eric Jarvis, who's an assistant professor at the Department of Psychiatry at McGill University.
So I'll be talking a bit from the ground up. I work as a clinician at the Jewish General Hospital, and in the Cultural Consultation Service, Lawrence Kiermaier already talked a bit about what that is. We basically give psychiatric opinion in the mental health of refugees and immigrants who are referred from a variety of sources, mostly from the community or in the hospital itself. And I should say the Jewish General Hospital is well represented by Anglophones. The French language is also well represented. But outside of these two languages, other languages are generally neglected in healthcare. I just wanted to outline what I'll be doing. I took the topic of this roundtable quite seriously. I'll set up three or four myths in language with respect to the people that we treat. I'll try to explain the reality and give an example of each. So the first myth I'll put forward to you in helping people from linguistically diverse backgrounds would go something like this. Generally speaking, there's not enough time or money to regularly use interpreters in the care of patients from linguistic minorities. So really, interpreters are a luxury and it can be discontinued in the interest of expediency and cost saving. So that's kind of a myth number one that I would say exists within the healthcare sector, at least the place where I work and with the people that I work with. Now, what about the reality part of this? I would suggest that not offering interpreters to patients from linguistic minorities is a basic breach of healthcare, mental health care, even ethical health care. And it can have significant impacts, negative impacts, on the people that we treat. So there's an excellent film called Worlds Apart from Stanford University, 2003. There are four parts to this sort of documentary. One of them talks specifically about a man from Afghanistan who was diagnosed with cancer, and the doctors talked to him about his prognosis and treatment options without the presence of an interpreter, and they thought that he said he refused treatment. And so his illness progressed to a terrible state, and then later his daughter came back, who was fluent in English, clearly, and said, well, did you ever have an interpreter present during the time you told my father about his illness? And the doctor didn't recall if that had happened. And the tragedy at the end was when they were interviewing the doctor, he said, well, unfortunately, this man refused treatment for his cancer. So that was sort of the official position, when in reality, the lack of an interpreter had probably contributed to a very negative outcome. So that's kind of myth number one about interpreters as being a luxury. What about this myth? See if I can go back. When interpreters are necessary, non-professional interpreters are usually sufficient. By non-professional interpreters, we would mean like a family member or a friend, or we don't really know who the person might be. They might be brought into the clinical situation, and there'll be an attempt to translate. Sometimes it's just hospital workers from different parts of the hospital who may come to help. Just as an on-call, out of the generosity of their hearts, they'll come and help. The reality is, for us, we find clinically in the Cultural Consultation Service and elsewhere that use of non-professional interpreters in clinical medicine should be a last resort, because there's all kinds of complications when you use family members to do the interpreting. And Dr. Kiermaier already told about one example where a case of domestic abuse where a woman fell silent because her husband was used as the interpreter. And there are many, many other situations or examples that I could use to illustrate this problem. So non-professional interpreters would be a last resort, not a first alternative, which is often the case. What about this kind of a third myth? In most clinical situations, patients from linguistically diverse backgrounds speak French or English well enough to describe their health problems or their mental health problems without interpreters. So this is common, we see this commonly in clinical medicine, where somebody's ill and they're trying to talk, they speak a little bit of English, a little bit of French, and that's enough for most people. The reality, we would say, is patients from linguistically diverse backgrounds often may speak some English or French, but really not enough to comfortably and in a detailed manner explain what they're suffering. And there are many, I can give many examples of this as well. Let me see if I can pull one up from my list. I remember seeing a couple where they were speaking with difficulty in the language of English. When we offered them an interpreter, the look of relief on their face was palpable in the room, and they began to speak much in a different way about the couple problems that they were going through, things they just could never have addressed if they had been limited to a basic English. The last myth I'll discuss with you, so I can find it here. Immigrants and refugees should take responsibility to provide their own interpreter if they need one. Unfortunately, sometimes some parts of the health sector, interpreters are cancelled altogether for different reasons, maybe economic reasons or other reasons. We find in reality when interpreters are not provided, immigrants and refugees simply seek health care elsewhere, or they may not seek health care at all. A recent example that we saw in our service, a woman that was from a very poor background, very humble background, no English or French capability. She was illiterate in her mother tongue, and so was even ineligible to learn French in Quebec, if you can imagine. And so she came to our clinic because she could no longer go to her family doctor since they wouldn't provide an interpreter for her, and we had to find ways to help her get back to medical treatment and also to address some psychiatric difficulties that she was having. So these are the four myths. There are many, perhaps many other ones. I'll just review for you fast. The first myth is that interpreters are more of a luxury than a necessity in healthcare. When interpreters are deemed to be necessary, maybe non-professional interpreters may be felt to be sufficient when in fact we would consider their use to be one of last resort. When you encounter patients in the clinic who can speak a little bit of French or English, instead of thinking that's enough, we would feel quite the contrary, that they would need an interpreter so they can describe their suffering adequately. And fourth of all, that if you leave it to immigrants and refugees, allophone population of Montreal and other places, to bring their own interpreters, they may just feel completely disenfranchised and will seek health care elsewhere or not at all. I gave a little bit of thought to some solutions to these issues on the ground. I think the first thing that I would hope, anyway, is that somehow the institutions of society, hospitals or government or both, would make it mandatory to offer at least an interpreter to the people that are seen in hospitals and other healthcare settings, and then to offer really the minimum amount of, it's not a huge amount of money, I think, that would go to helping people to have adequate communication with their physicians and nurses. So a solution for me would be for the hospitals and the government to make policies demanding and requiring the use of interpreters in these settings. The second solution that I would see and would hope for is that there be a real revamping of training of healthcare professionals from the beginning. It's very discouraging when I work in McGill University Hospital, see end-stage psychiatric residents who at the last 1 or 2 years of their training who have never used an interpreter through all the time of their medical and specialty training. And so if interpreters could be introduced as a way of doing clinical medicine from medical school all the way through at regular intervals, we would be far, far ahead in the game of providing really essential health care to the people that we see. And so a couple of my questions would be for you, would be like this. So we see patients who go to court and who seem to have access to health or to interpreters in the court setting. Is there something we could learn from legal settings that we could put into healthcare as a way to make interpreters more generally available, or come to see it as more of a basic right to communicate with your lawyer, with the court as a basic right? What about communicating with your doctor as well as being a basic right? What about this? If language interpreters really are seen as a luxury in our society, it may not be very available to most allophone people, or maybe even to anglophone or francophone patients in different settings. What kind of health care do linguistic minorities really receive on the ground in our healthcare system as it is today? So those are my thoughts. Thank you.
We have time for a couple of questions directly for Eric. Yes. Joanne, yes, thanks.
Hi there. I really appreciate your approach to the topic of the interpreter and the way that it's come up. And I think what's interesting to me is the, in my experience, the English-speaking communities, especially in perhaps the more rural settings, are aging at a more rapid rate than their Francophone counterpart. So we have a lot of English-speaking seniors out there who also find themselves in a situation where they don't have their family close by. So there's a kind of missing middle generation that's a phenomenon of the English-speaking community. And that has to do with what Richard Boris was mentioning as the exodus during a certain period of time and so on. So you find now a large number of English-speaking seniors, they don't have their family in proximity to the same degree as the Francophone. So in the course of my contact and interviewing with community organizations in that situation who are involved in, you know, they're in the community sector and finding support for the seniors, English-speaking seniors, it's brought to my attention the extent to which those seniors look for someone to go to the clinic, to the hospital, to the health organization with them. So they look for someone to accompany them. The organization has a problem on their hands in that their volunteers providing transportation find themselves in a difficult situation because the senior wants them to come in, accompany them to their appointment and effectively serve as interpreter, yeah. Or their taxi driver is in a conundrum.
Whoever's available.
Because he wants to help the senior, but you know he can't leave the meter running, and I don't even know if there's legal issues that surround all this. But what strikes me in all of this, I hear you talking about interpreter, and I suddenly am able to frame it that way. It's not framed that way. They're saying that the English-speaking senior doesn't have a caregiver to accompany them, and they sort of put it under the role of caregiving, and that's absent for these seniors, and that something has to be done about that. And I'm just thinking part of the solution might be to understand that situation is a demand for an interpreter. In other words, track it from the point of view of the patient, track it from the point of view of the client using the service as a situation where an interpreter was not available, as in a family. Do you know what I'm saying? So
yeah.
Track the need for the interpreter perhaps better than it's being tracked, because it seems to be kind of invisible. It's caught up under other issues in trying to support seniors in engaging institutions, and I don't think it's being tracked in the terms that might be useful for your ends.
So documenting the need of interpreters in all different kinds of settings. Yeah, I think that's excellent. Yeah, I think you're probably right.
Two comments about the solutions that you pointed out. It's true that if the interpreter issue, so if you frame it in terms of an interpretation issue, there is perhaps recourse to some kind of solution. However, I mean, the court, there is a precedent with Eldridge, with providing sign language interpretation in British Columbia in the hospitals. However, I think there's a difference between that kind of interpretation and the means to help existing English language communities and the kind of issues that you raise about refugee communities, because then the legal environment is not the same, so the legal rights are not the same. And also, I mean, frankly, because now much of the care of refugees has been taken off the responsibility of the federal government and downloaded to provinces who are willing to take it up, I don't see where the resources would come from. But just also another, you know, the first thing you said is, can we make healthcare a right? The thing is, healthcare isn't a right. I mean, constitutionally speaking, it's not a right. So that would be a more difficult path, even though it seems, you know, more logically in terms of the work that you do, what you would want to see.
Thank you.